to a degree they're right. I haven't really, done that much of it. It's not my favorite mode. I've heard my own echoes off the moon, and they're fun to listen to. But I haven't heard clear voice off the moon, with the exception of the Apollo astronauts. I've heard their signals off the moon, nice clear audio on the FM modulation. I've heard the audio from Goldstone dish aimed up at the astronauts during the time the command module was in front of the moon, and so therefore the moon bounce echo from the Goldstone dish, I've listened to that. And when you're using a 260-foot dish with 10 kilowatts of power, boy, that's nice-sounding FM coming off that moon. A little bit picket-fancy because of the moon's vibration effect, that was spreading, but that's good audio off the moon. But that's an exception, obviously. That's a very serious piece of hardware. Not many of us are going to put one of those together in our backyard for some time to come. Moonbound separates the men from the boys in the past. It's rather difficult. 432, you're overcoming 263 decibels of loss between your transmitting piece of coax and your receiving piece of coax. You're overcoming 263 dB. So that's what the path loss is. And it takes, in general, a lot of steam, a lot of antenna, a very good low noise preamp on the receiver, and hopefully you live in a quiet portion of the world. Doing moon bounce in Manhattan would be awfully difficult because of local radio noise. Not impossible, awfully difficult. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, some final words on it. If you really are interested in EME, would you say going to 432 because of the advantage of the tracking distance being half that of a 144 megahertz antennas and making the ray over 144, in other words, say a quarter, one-fourth that of a 144 megahertz array as versus 432. In other words, is it worth the going to 432 because of the smaller array situation over?
It's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Mel. If you've got a limited number of square feet where you can build an antenna into, as you go to 432, you do get three times the directivity out of the antenna. The same amount of square feet of antenna is going to give you one-third of the beam width, therefore more of the energy hits the moon. That's the good news. The bad news, 432 has more path loss. Not so good news. How much echo you get off the moon, how much you're able to capture, is a function of your effective area of your receiver and the noise figure of your preamp. And if you're trying to compare which is more difficult, 2 meters versus 432, for a limited amount of real estate, you're building this array on top of the roof of your apartment building, we'll say. Want to drop? Yeah, I thought so. Machine's got to be reset periodically. Is 2 meters easier or is 432 easier? I can see plus and minuses of each. In the past, the average guy could build a lower noise figure with the preamp on 2 meters than he could on 432. That's no longer true. In the past, the available tubes would allow you to generate more power on 2 meters than 432. That's not very true anymore. The amount of man-made noise on 2 meters is considerably higher than it is on 432. That's not so good. The amount of Faraday rotation you get on 2 meters is three times higher than you'll get on 432. You can have a really big antenna on 2 meters, a really high power transmitter, a really good low-noise preamplifier, and a quiet location. Put that all together and you say, boy, I'm going to get potent echoes off that moon every time I want to demonstrate it to anybody that visits me. Sounds good. The guy that your buddy visits, the time that your buddy visits you, and you show him what the echoes sound like, you transmit, and there's nothing there. And you say, what in the world is going on? Well, that particular hour of that particular day, Mother Nature decided to take your horizontal signal that goes to the ionosphere, gets a twist, hits the moon, comes back to the ionosphere, gets another twist, and it comes back cross-polarized. You're launching horizontal, and what you're receiving is vertical, and your antenna says, ain't nothing there. You get, I think it goes up by square law, so you get 1/9 of the Faraday rotation on 432 than you do 2 meters. So that random variable almost disappears. I think there are more interesting people to talk to in 432 than there are 2 meters. A little bit more progressive, a little higher frequency thinking people. So, what little bit of moon bounce I've done was on 432. I've done none on 2 meters. But I'm not a 2 meter man. You could do both. And which is better? Well, will I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette? In both cases, there's a lot more variables than first meets the eye. So, ain't easy to say. You could also ask the next question. Would I be better off building a dish and doing moon bounce on 1296? A few guys have done it with the Aggies, but most guys on 1296 and above have done it with parabolic dish antennas. Would I get more bang for the dollar and more pleasure on 1296? Well, you can have a considerably smaller number of people to talk to. Get a hold of KTUIH, start getting the 432 EME news, which is printed once every lunar month. He's been doing that.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KTUIH, Dr. Alan Katz, has been printing the 432 EME newsletter every single lunar month for 30 solid years. You start reading issues of that. It's about a 4-page, both sides of the paper, 8-page total newsletter every single month, which you can get online. Go to KTUIH and EME. Just do Google those words, you'll find him. Start reading some of those newsletters. You'll find out who in the world is doing what hardware they're using. You'll see beautiful pictures of the hardware. If he assembled all of those, man, would that make one hell of a book on the subject. There's more than 1 million words available to you on the subject of EME by reading past issues of the 432 and above EME news of K2UIH. So I think the strongest opinion I can manufacture here is that before you put forth a considerable amount of effort, start reading what other people have done and make a decision. Hey, this sounds like fun. That doesn't sound like fun to me. As you read what other people have done. How do they build the feed on? How do they build the low noise amplifier? How do they build the antenna? How do they build the transmitter? How do they buy the receiver? And so on. How do they tune the low noise amplifier? What feed lines do they use? What steers the azimuth and elevation of the antenna? How do you calculate where the moon's going to be? How do you calculate where the sky background noise is going to be from the center of the universe? On 2 meters, that sky background noise can be very significant. On 432, it's nowhere near as bad. At 1296, you come closer to ignoring it. As you can see, on each of these frequencies where hams have done moon bounce, there's all kinds of pluses and minuses. Reasonably complicated issue. A lot to learn. Do a little research before you start cutting aluminum, is my opinion. But there are people who just jumped in with both feet, start building and tuning, and eventually ended up very happy. It doesn't always work at first. All good new ideas don't work at first. But if you've got the perseverance, if you've got some Edisonian philosophy, you make it work. You keep trying, you eliminate the bugs, you use divide and conquer, and pretty soon it flies. K2KEY,
K2LIW. Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, to summarize, it said that a larger array would allow for a greater margin of error. And if your system, in other words, if you want to get, like you say, the most out of it, I guess it still comes down to the larger array allows for the greater margin of error. Correct, over?
Absolutely. The more power you transmit, the lower noise figure you receive, the bigger antenna with better standing wave ratio, the higher front-to-back ratio on the antenna so it's not looking at hot earth in the back lobes. All of these things go into a quieter area, build it in a place where there's not trees on your horizon where you can soak the antenna, closer to the horizon, all of these things will increase the pleasure. The more you invest in EME, the more pleasure, in theory, you can get back out of it. You can start off fairly simple and keep adding to it, but there's a lot of things you can keep adding to that system. You can always use a bigger antenna, a more accurate ASL steering mechanism, a higher power output, higher efficiency transmitter, cleaner signals, less the chirp to the signal, lower noise figure receiver, better noise blanker, better IF filtering, better dynamic range to the receiver, better weak signal Joe Taylor techniques for demodulating the signal. It goes on and on. That particular portion of our hobby really separates the men from the boys. It's pretty close to the highest technology we've got. Real high performance phone sound. Ain't easy. It's getting a hell of a lot easier. In fact, the old timers are complaining about the fact that the guys who started in 1975 had to put up 400 square feet of antenna, had to build a transmitter with 1200 watts of output, had to have half a dB noise figure or better, had to put up 16 Yagis, had to have a steering mechanism that's good to the nearest 2 degrees azimuth in elevation, had to live in a quiet location, and they worked a certain number of states, a certain number of countries. A couple of years ago, along comes the weak signal Joe Taylor technique, and guys with 10 or 15% of that amount of hardware are working almost the same number of countries and states. So the old timers are saying, hey, I've made a 20-year investment to get where I am, and these guys come along with modern-day techniques, and they're doing it in 2 months. And that's not fair. There should be a separate way of accounting this, to keep records of how many countries and how many states and how many grids you've worked, how many Maidenhead grid squares. I live in Fox November 30 grid square. Mel lives in Fox November 20, and so on. There are people who collect grid squares, people who collect states, people who collect countries, who collect call letter prefixes. There's all kinds of moon-bounce ways of considering it a challenge. And yes, it works better and better as you invest more and more. And I think your caller, your mailbag person is asking, what's the minimum requirement? It can be done on 2 Yagis, on 2 meters at 432. It can be done with an 8 or 10 foot dish on 1296. There are guys with a 6 to 8 foot dish and 10 watts of power on 10 gigahertz who have done moonbounce. It's not a robust station, but it's the minimum, and it works. 10 or 20 watts, 8-foot dish, half dB noise figure, 10 gigahertz, you can do moonbounce. There are guys doing it with an 18-foot dish and 500 watts of power, and boy, are they potent by comparison. Moonbounce has been done now on essentially every ham band. I'm not sure about 10 meters. I know 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 432, 1296, 900, 902, 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, and 21 gigs. There are guys starting to hear echoes on 47 gigs, but I don't think it's been done yet. I went to the microwave update in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago, talked to those people who are building that hardware. Talked to the people who have done 21 gigahertz moonbounce. VE4MA, Barry Malawanchak, I think is his name, works for Manitoba Power and Light. He's number one on, I think it's 21 gigs moonbounce. Him and WA5 LUA, now W5 LUA. Those are some of the big guns on that particular band. So you could say moonbounce has been done on just about every single VHF band, every single UHF band, almost every single SHF band, and now they're working on the EHF bands. doing moon bounce. I don't think anybody's done moon bounce on 15 meters. K2, without using the Arecibo dish. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Not quite. This is K2KEY. Oh, one question I wanted to ask you, being that we're on the subject. How much time during the month do you have for EME? When is it favorable? In other words, favorable 1 out of 30 days, 2 out of 30 days, so many hours. I mean, is there a rule of thumb for that? Take over.
This is the W.
Okay. If I've got a fairly clear piece of land where I can tilt the dish all the way down to the horizon, and the 28-day lunar month, some of that month the moon is 9 degrees below the equator. Some portion of the month, half of the month, the moon is 9 degrees above the equator. That's a variable. Whether or not the moon is in front of the sun, whether or not the moon is in front of the noisiest portion of our universe, the center of the galaxy, the Cygnus constellation, that's a variable. Some people can't do moon bounce in a high wind, can't do it with an ice storm, can't do it in the rain. Most of them can. A guy reasonably well equipped can do moon bounce, in my opinion, more than 15 days per month. I didn't say all those days are favorable, but you can do some kind of moon bounce very close to half the days of the month if you're well equipped. Now you start putting in there the variables of, hey, I don't want to do it at 2 o'clock in the morning. I want to do it during normal business hours. I've got trees that won't allow me to go any closer than 20 degrees to the horizon. I've got local noise that's turned on certain hours of the day. You start adding those kind of variables, and I might be down to 6 days per month that are favorable. But if everything else is going good for you, I think you can do some kind of moon bounce darn close to 15 days per month. Mel, go ahead.
Okay. Sounds like it would be interesting to try. I know I was once, well, basically involved only to the point where I supplied the transmitter for it. That was your transmitter that wound up the guy that was very involved with getting into moved out EME on 2 meters. Anyhow, very good. Want to try one more, Dick?
Yeah, I do remember there was a big gun on 2 meter moonbound in Brooklyn for quite a few years. I wonder if he was supporting that operation, and I'm trying to remember that guy's call letters.
W-H-W-O-N.
I think that's the one. Mel, were you involved in that operation?
Somewhat. I won't get into that. Talk to you someday personally and tell you some stories. All right. Would you like to take another one?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Here's somebody. Now, this is interesting. I saw office a number of surf bus Loran C calibrating units. Do they have any value as a system to use for a frequency standard? I don't know. Is Loran C still around, Dick? Over.
I think it is. I believe Loran C operates at 100 kilohertz. It's a very good maritime navigation system with limited application near the seashore over land. But a 100 KC signal propagates at a slightly different rate over land than it does over the sea. So you have to add some correction factors when it comes to figuring out your position with Loran C. Now, yeah, Loran C is a very accurate 100 KC signal. That's the good news. But because you're not getting that signal direct, you're getting it through some kind of ionospheric interaction, and that ionospheric interaction is continuously changing. Therefore, you don't just zero beat the a low-NC transmitter and say, aha, my crystal is right on. You have to integrate that answer over some significant period of time, maybe 24 hours or more, depending on what accuracy you're looking for. If you want extremely high frequency accuracy these days, the smart people are using global positioning satellite receivers, or they're using the network-produced programs where the 3.579545 megahertz chrominance subcarrier of network color television transmission, that signal, that exact frequency, is traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. So, if you want real high-frequency accuracy, you use WWV, broadcast 3.57 megs, global positioning satellite receivers. The people who are doing oscillator disciplining, as they call it, where they want extremely high accuracy so that the net result is they're within 1 hertz of the stated frequency on 10,000 megacycle ham radio. The majority of those people are building circuits, telling each other how to do it. CT1, can't remember his call letters, CT1 TK or something like that, it's the call letters of the guy who is sort of heading that operation of taking various brands of global positioning satellite receivers and taking the internal oscillator output after it's been locked up on a satellite and using that to set the exact frequency of their 10 megacycle reference crystal for the shack. That's right now the most accurate way to do it, Mel. KQLIW.
Hey, you brought up a good point. If I was again, picking up junk four-man stuff like we always just say subsidized, and I found the Laura NC, and I used it in comparison, let's say, to the Colorbird TV broadcast signal and to WWV signal. Are they compatible to the so-called atomic, you know, cesium standards derived from atomic clocks, Dick? Are they traceable to one another over?
Absolutely. At the transmitter. And there's the catch. If you live directly next door to a 100 KC transmitter for Loran C, you've got an extremely good atomic clock traceable National Bureau of Standards frequency transmission. But once that signal has been through some number of miles of free space, bounced in various ways by the ionosphere and the Earth, and it arrives in your backyard, and that ionosphere is always moving in Faraday rotation, point source of reflection, altitude, reflection coefficient, angles, whatever, that ionosphere is continuously moving, very similar to the shadows you see in the bottom of your pool on a sunny day, the scintillation effect. The water moving in your pool is very similar to what the atmosphere is doing, and you could say to a small degree the ionosphere is doing that. So you're getting kind of a signal that's going up and down in amplitude and back and forth in phase through that medium at 100 KC into your Loran C receiver. So by the time you get it, you have to average it over some significant period of time in order to get back out of it all the decimal places of accuracy that was there at the instant it was transmitted. The trouble is you ain't getting the same signal that was transmitted. You're getting something that's been through a lot of jazz before it got to you. Whereas when you listen to a GPS receiver that's coming directly from a satellite at 1,572 megacycles down through the atmosphere, straight into your receiver, direct line of sight, that's a much cleaner signal at a much higher frequency. Therefore, to you, it has much higher accuracy over a much shorter period of time. So, and by the same token, when you got standard broadcast network TV, it is directly traceable to that atomic clock. And for that matter, I think also the 60-cycle line frequency is directly traceable to that atomic clock. But there the frequency is so low, you've got to wait a long time to get all those decimals of accuracy. Because your accuracy really is, you could say, primarily a function of how many cycles did you count. If I'm doing it a 60-cycle read, well, I got to wait a long time to count a zillion cycles. If I'm doing it at 1,572 megacycles, I don't have to wait anywhere near as long to count the right number of cycles to get the accuracy, particularly if it's coming through a nice, clean medium directly from the satellite into my hand, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Fine business. Yeah, very, very interesting to consider. But this is the day and age, how we've come a long way from things that one time we thought was the cutting edge, like you say, of technology, to getting a back seat now. Let's see. All right. Oh boy, I don't know. Let me read over something. Fiber optics, I don't know if we should touch fiber optics. I don't think this is for us, fiber optics take over.
Well, the really progressive hams are into optical communication. Far infrared, near infrared, optical, and ultraviolet. There are hams that are experimenting with that. The current distance record with optical ham radio is a guy in Texas on one mountain and a guy in Oklahoma on another mountain, 153 miles away, aiming telescopes at each other, demodulating the MCW, modulated Morse code, tone-modulated Morse code over an optical link. That's not quite fiber optics, but it's optical. Right now, way back in the days when you and I were cutting our teeth in ham radio, we had all kinds of assignments for the 80, 40, 20, 15, 10 meter band, and you work your way all the way up, and it used to be all above 3 gigahertz. Later on, it became all above 30 gigahertz. Nowadays, it's all above 300 gigahertz, and that's going to change. Pretty soon, it's going to be, you have completely license-free, all above 3 terahertz. So we're moving toward optical. We're moving at a pretty good rate toward optical. You'd be amazed how many guys are fiddling with 21 gigs, 47 gigs, 78 gigs, 120, 140, 241, 311, 412 gigs. Contacts have been made on every one of those frequency ranges. I've talked to the people who have done it. I'm envious of them. They're on the cutting edge. I'm sitting here watching them do it, wishing I was involved. So, fiber optics got an awful lot going for it. You can send a signal with no amplification under the Atlantic Ocean from eastern United States to western Europe by fiber optic technique. That's a lot of miles per dB. We tried doing that by coax cable, by twin lead, by any other kind of sea buried cable. And boy, you just can't touch fiber optics. Fiber to the curb and fiber to the house will be a reality. There's no other way we can get the bandwidth. And boy, can that give you bandwidth. Wow. It's not too expensive. It's got tremendous capability. I can remember the days in 1971 when Bell Laboratories was inventing a technique that was going to work at 94 gigahertz, where they're going to put a quarter of a million telephone conversations through a 2-inch diameter pipe. I think it was called the T2 system. I'm not quite sure what it was called. And in its
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In its day, that was the state of the art. Most signals per one cable. 2-inch diameter pipe, quarter of a million conversations. Now you can multiply that by 1,000, and it's a fiber that's a 16th of an inch in diameter, 32nd of an inch in diameter. And it's got a lot less feed line, it's got a lot less insertion loss. We've come a long way. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, roger. of things to come in the future. Okay, very good. Whole bunch of things here. I don't know if I don't know if you have any idea what you're speaking about. The DSP system that uses the by that was invented by the what? Johnson Company. You ever hear of it, Dick?
Yeah, I've worked with WJ a whole lot of times. Palo Alto, California is where they used to be. I think they've moved to Sunnyvale or someplace like that. WJ does some very nice work. In fact, I am personally using some of their complete radio on a chip integrated circuit. So they do some very nice work. Go ahead, Mel.
WQL repeater system.
Hey, Roger. If you are familiar with the, give some hints on the Watson Johnson DSP processing system, and if it's superior to, what the heck is it? Oh, to other communication systems, basically looking at a communication system using the Watson Johnson HF-1000 receiver system, utilizing 58 selectable IF bandwidth ranging from 56 Hz to 8 kHz, using synchronous detection on AM, WFM, ISP, and so on and so forth. I don't know, I can't comment on this. I'm not familiar with this receiver that, can't find anything. You ever hear of the Watson Johnson HF-1000? Over.
I personally have not, but at that microwave update conference I went to 2 weeks ago, a lot of those people were talking about that. A significant one-third of the conference, you could say, inadvertently was devoted to the subject of SDR, Software Defined Radios. Elecraft right now is making a very exciting sounding chip called the Elecraft E3, I think it is, or the T3, the third version of the Elecraft radio. It is a software-defined radio. The progressive people in that conference, 180 people, I imagine half of them were in the room at the time I asked the question of these so-called software-defined radio experts. I said, in your opinion, what percentage of ham radio progressive people 5 years from now will be using a software-defined radio, which really means most of the functions are controlled by computer-like functions, and all of the filtering, per se, is being done by digital signal processing? That's what a software-defined radio is, in my mind. It does its Q-multiplying, its filtering, it's a notching, it's a tunable IF, it's a shop of brick wall filters, audio roofing filter, IF filter, pre-selected, post-selected filtering, digital signal, processing technique, enhancement, whatever. What percentage of ham radio progressive people 5 years from now will be using those radios? And the majority of the people in that room who are studying that subject and have been doing it for 5 or 10 years said that more than 60% of the progressive hands will be using an SDR radio 5 years from now. So, just like the future you and I watched happen, Mel, when in the mid-70s, transistorized receivers started coming onto the market. And they had a shaky beginning. But nowadays, you wouldn't do it any other way. That's approximately where we are with software-defined radios. Some people think they've had a shaky beginning. Try to buy an Elecraft Model 3 radio. For the next 4 months, they're already sold out even before they've been produced. People are wanting that thing that bad. So everything I see tells me if you and I don't get on that bandwagon, Mel, if we're not careful, we're going to become dinosaurs. It won't be the first time. but I've become a dinosaur. K2KEY, K2LAW.
KA2ZEV, joining the fossil. How are you?
Wow. Long time no hear. My goodness. You've been all over the world since I last talked to you.
Yeah, it's always exciting when strangers are trying to kill you. How are you? How you been?
You and I should have a landline. I've been a lot busier than I want to be. I ain't complaining, but trying to remember the last time you and I met. Could have been at your wedding. I think it was at your wedding, and Nipper was there with you. I'm trying to remember if you and I have had a QSO since then. What do you think?
Quite, full time at Ammonia, Maryland.
Okay, Mike. Yes, you're right. I think that was since your wedding. So, I believe you're living in Virginia these days, and I presume you're visiting Long Island.
Yeah, I hope the other guy doesn't mind that I'm crashing his party here. Yeah, back in Herndon. I'm no longer deployable. And, when I get you on the phone or if you answer your email, I'll bring you up to speed as to what's going on. I've been keeping in touch with your son, and the expression great things are afoot should stir your interest.
Yeah, we got to talk, Mike. And I'm involved in a couple of crazy projects. You probably are also. My son's having an interesting time. Glad you're keeping in touch with him. And so you joined us as we're talking about software-defined radios. I wonder if in your travels you've seen or heard any of those, Mike.
Yeah, there's a neat one that the troopers are using called the M-Biter, made by Sales in Maryland. Most advanced things. I forget the minimum and maximum, but it does anything a Syngar can do and a decent sized up to a UHF radio. So, no matter what channel you want, what encryption you want, bang, it's there. And I got to see a tour of the factory and how they were manufactured. Sorry, the amount of effort to make these radios.
I can tell by the strength of the signal, you're most likely in Suffolk County or very close to Suffolk County. And so it sounds like you've seen some of these things. Quick question to Mel. Mel, how much have you heard about software-defined radios? Have you, just like me, sort of ignored it up till now? And you go to a conference of progressive people and you hear them talk about it. Slowly concluding it's going to be hard to keep ignoring them in the future. I think they're going to become dominant. K2KEY, the group, K2LAW.
BB2BXL.
Okay. Good evening, Frank. Yeah, Vic, this is K2KEY. You know, it must be a little bit of the ESP between us because, all right, first I'll pick up Frank and then I'll tell you what happened with the you mentioned the Ellicraft, the K3. Tell you about an experience this week. Well, I'm not going to bring it. I wasn't going to bring it up on the net. But being at the flight now and all, I can say a few words about it. But I will say something in the first place. Let me see if you can help Frank. LB2BXO and it was KKY. Go ahead, Frank.
Hey, very, very good. First of all, I want to say I'm really delighted to hear how those K3s are flying off the shelf. I know Wayne personally. When Wayne Burdick and I probably, you probably know, Dick, Wayne is KR, one of the founders, one of the inventors of that radio. Wayne and I used to keep skeds every Saturday afternoon on 15 meters CW when we were kids, teenagers. and kept in touch off and on for a while, and occasionally see each other at AtlanticCon, and very infrequently on the air since then. So I'm very glad to hear how well he was. He's doing. He was a really amusing kid. Anyway, the other thing I'm wondering about, I've been listening to you talk about the Philadelphia conference for several weeks now. I'm going to be moving down to that area next year because that's where my fiancée lives and has a very good job. They're doing something down there called Wireless Philly, supposedly blanketing the city. I think Earthlink, the subcontractor, is actually doing the work, wiring, quote-unquote, the city with Wi-Fi. I was wondering if the guys at your conference spoke about this Wireless Philly thing at all and how well you thought it would work. Go ahead, Dick. WB2BX.
You don't have to go anywhere near that far, Frank. The whole town of Huntington Township is in the process of completely wiring the town with Wi-Fi. And they wanted to have the characteristics such that even a person sitting on a train with a PCMCIA card plugged into his laptop or whatever will be able to communicate so-called seamlessly at 40 miles an hour on a train anywhere in Huntington Township for anyone in a vehicle or whatever. There's been testimonials by the fact that all the officials in the town want to start using it. They don't want to be using their phone cards in order for all their officers to call into the town hall to get their next assignment and so on. So Huntington Town is doing it. My prediction is that Oyster Bay Town won't even consider it for 10 years. They are scared to death of anything with the word RF radiation to it. And my relatives that live in Bayville, Long Island, are going through an episode right now where a high percentage of the residents of the town are suing the town to remove every single antenna that is capable of radiating a radio signal from that town. Their feeling is that strong on that subject. My relatives won't turn on their laptop computer when their child is in the house. They don't own a microwave oven. They won't use a cell phone when the child is within view of them. And most of them are afraid to use a cell phone or a cordless phone. A significant number of people in the town have acquired the opinion because of the so-called cancer cluster of a student and a faculty member of the local school, the middle school, both developed cancer, and the antennas on the water tower are next door to that school. As far as they're concerned, that's cause and effect, and the subject can no longer be discussed. I gave testimony before that town. Now, in the case of a microwave update that was held in Philadelphia this year, it's going to be held in somewhere close to Detroit, Michigan next year. The previous year it was held in Seattle, Washington. Before that was Dallas, Texas. It moves around. So, if Philadelphia is about to become Wi-Fi, let me drop a second, Wi-Fi connected, and an interesting question is, will they be doing it better or worse sooner or later than Huntington Township? Interesting question. But it's obvious that this is the wave of the future, and I think many progressive communities will be so equipped in the near future. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm just wondering, is it possible to do in a whole metropolitan area without having a lot of dead spots at 2.4 gigs? Or is it likely to require one of these external antennas I've seen in a DAES catalog? MFJ has a Wi-Fi beam I saw. This is another thing I was curious about, because I've heard you say on the TechNet that it's very difficult to develop a Yagi for the tolerances required. Frequency is much above 900 megahertz, and MFJ is selling one of these things that presumably works reasonably well for Wi-Fi at 2.4 gigahertz. couple of questions in flight there, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, Frank, your signal has... Let me drop it. Your signal has become reasonably noisy. You've moved to a noisy location or you're down to a lower power. You're about 40% noise, but fully copyable. And by the way, Mike, when it comes back to you, your audio was quite low. You could use a little bit more audio. If you're willing to put in enough access points with enough high locations and whatever, covering a zillion square miles is very doable. When I said that Yagis above 1296 have problems with water droplets on them, I'm talking about conventional Yagis built or purchased by ham radio operators located outdoors. If you're willing to put the right kind of a radome around the Yagi, if you're willing to build it in as a loop Yagi structure where the water drops down to the center of the loop near the boom and doesn't have any effect, there's all kinds of ways around it. There are some extremely good Yagi antennas that you can buy all the way up to 5.6 gigahertz. If you go to Directive Systems, which is K1WHS's company in West Lebanon, Maine, they make some very nice products. So there are ways around these problems. I'm just telling people that you can just simply build a Yagi and scale it down in size and run it at 2 gigs and put it outdoors on a wet day. You're going to be disappointed if you don't apply some corrective action. So building antennas with gain at 2.6 gigs, I own a few of those. They're usually dish antennas, but they don't have to be. I don't own any Yagis up there, but I could. So you put in enough access points, I think you can get 98% coverage of a town. Now, is it going to work when you're in the sub-basement of a main building that's built with steel structure? If they're not willing to put a micro cell site equivalent down there, maybe you're going to have spotty coverage. But the technology is there. You give me enough access points, I can give you 98% coverage in that town. Back to you, Frank.
Welcome to the W2DL repeater. Good evening.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the picture showing the AES catalog of this 2.4 gig Wi-Fi Yagi looks pretty conventional. No fancy loops or anything, but it's meant for indoor use, just to clip on a desk or clip on the back of your computer or something like that. I guess how well it works depends on how sharply you can aim it and stuff also. Anyway, I found that interesting. I guess the other issue, which really isn't a radio issue at all, is how secure these community Wi-Fi systems are going to be, whether it's going to be secure enough to use as your main internet access at home and sit there and do your banking on them and stuff. But, you know, that could probably depend on the individual provider and what level of encryption they provide and the like. Go ahead.
I know a number of people who do all of the interconnect connection by way of Wi-Fi. If you've got the right kind of firewall system, you've got the right kind of, what's the word for it now? There's all kinds of ways you can make security. So that's not too much of an issue from my point of view, Frank. I didn't say you can ignore the situation, but the techniques are there right now to give you a moderate amount of protection. So when it comes to a whole community with Wi-Fi, properly installed and properly maintained, properly designed, I don't see much of a problem yet. And when the problem does happen, there's going to be a couple of bugs in the system. There's ways around it. There's always going to be some smart guy writing a good piece of software that's going to give you a whole lot of protection. Not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. There's always going to be people writing very crafty viruses. I'm not quite sure what their motivation is, but the capability is there, and there's always going to be people doing it. And we're always going to have law enforcement agencies hunting them down, and a small percentage of them will be prosecuted, and examples will be made. That's sort of predictable. Mike, I'm going to have you say a few more words. This is the tail end of the TechNet, which starts at 8 o'clock every night. This is our 25th year as of last September, and it's still going. I'm amazed that it still exists. Maybe you came back to the neighborhood, and you're amazed that it still exists. I wonder if you're in Green Lawn. KE2ZEV, KQRIW in the tech net.
KE2RIW and something KA2ZEV. No, I'm just up for the weekend. High school 30th reunion. Essentially, I wanted to go back and laugh at some of the druggies. Some of them actually made good. It was interesting being in a room full of people I barely remember. But that's why I'm here. Tomorrow I drive back down to Virginia. I didn't want to try and drive through the remains of the marathon traffic today. And that's the nature of the excitement.
Were you involved in the marathon today, Mike? And I think you're driving your car right now. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm driving around looking at the old neighborhood, wondering what's changed, what's new, what's old. And a while back, I swore up anything ending in O-Zon. I just got so tired of it.
I can understand that. Okay, yeah. Mel, do you think we should take another one? The choice is yours.
I'm getting kind of late. We've got a few minutes left. This is KQKQY. You brought up the Elecrip, and Frank mentioned it also. I was known for many years out there in California now with Elecrip, and kind of well. Let me put it this way. I got a chance this week to work with the K3. The new one that they just introduced. And Dick, we compared it. We did some, well, just really not the laboratory standard of comparison that I would normally really require, but just perusing over this piece of equipment in comparison to a couple of other high-end pieces of gear by three of the main big manufacturers. And this Elecrip Dick receiver has got it over all of them. It's amazing. I didn't believe that really had heard the, you know, the through the grapevine, as you say, of how good it is. But I think it is the, if, well, let's put it this way. If I was looking to build or buy another HF transceiver of some sort, this would definitely be the radio for me. Over.
Fascinating. Now, when you said we, does that mean Mel and the mouse in his pocket? Or does it mean the Kings County Radio Club? How did you get access to one? And if I know you, you did an on-the-air comparison side-by-side, connected to the same antenna, maybe with a T-connector, listening to the same signal. I think you should give us a few more words. Whose was it? Where was it? What'd you do and what'd you hear? Go ahead, Mel.
This is Kate. Hey, this is Kate. Kate, why I'll say a few words. A friend of mine brought him up from down south to up here on some business. And, well, he's basically connected with electronics and all, but he also has a source, a very good source of equipment that he can sort of borrow, but... he buys a lot. I don't know if I should say so much about him personally, you know, and everything like that. But he brought this K3, and I did listen to it, first of all, on the air. I was very impressed. And I said, okay, let me take it down to my so-called, you know, lab. I'm not going to say it, you know, anything up to standard today. I'm using old Hewlett Packard signal generators and things of that sort that, of course, you and I would know quite well the equipment. But of course, anybody else look at it today and would sort of thumb their nose. And in comparison, basically, I did some comparison, and I wanted to see selectivity. And the receiver, forget about the transmitter. The transmitters all sound the same. They all work real well now. So I didn't bother really anything to do with the transmitter. But the receiver, Dick, it was phenomenal. How I could move in within a few kilohertz and signal at S9 and listen to another signal that was like S5 or less, and get the perfect copy on it with almost it on. In other words, it's pulled. It has this roofing filters and all in there that they came up with that are phenomenal, that the strongest signal almost has to be literally zero beat on it before it would pull the primary signal off frequency over.
Okay. I think I've heard a minor complaint that the audio output didn't have enough power. When you listen with earphones, it was perfect, but you power a loudspeaker, it wasn't loud enough. I think it's about the only complaint I've ever heard. If you wanted to add something to that Elecraft K3, Mel, what would you add if this is the best of all worlds? Or are you about to say, right now, this is as good as it gets that you know about? Back to you, Mel.
Let me put it to you this way, Dick. What I would like to see, I'd like to see a standalone receiver. Because, you know, if you took a standalone, if you had this as a standalone receiver and used this for the basis of whether you want to use it as a tunable IF or just use a straight HF receiver, I think this is the technology. I've only heard it one other time on a standalone receiver, a Rodin-Schwarz receiver. This is what I remember hearing, seeing, Dick. This is very, I would say, exact to it, almost carbon copy over.
Okay. So, it's as good as the Rodin-Schwarz, or maybe better. Was the Rode also a software-defined radio, or was that a more conventional radio when you were using it, Mel?
The Rodin-Schwarz was a few years old already, but of course it was the receivers at the time. And I don't know what now, one or two have come out on the market in the last year, and they haven't reviewed them yet. I think that the ARRL does have the facility to do a good review on them, but it seems like they only stick to the three big manufacturers and their transceivers. I'd like to see what they say about some of this. I don't know if you've seen this new one, this FDR that ICOM came out with. I looked into it already. The price tag is way up. You buy literally a compact car for what it even costs. And here I got a piece of equipment here that is cheaper than most of the transceivers or what is on the market now today is transceivers. It's within that price range. This, to me, was kind of a big surprise, Dick, over.
Once again, the surprise was, which brand name was a lot cheaper, Mel?
Elecraft K3. They're offering a, I guess I can say it because it's a QFT. They're offering the K3 for under $2,000. And I really was looking at a piece of equipment that we were comparing, and that piece of equipment is at least four times the amount. Now, I didn't get a chance to, he didn't bring one other piece of equipment, which I would like to, but he said it's too much to drag. They have one that's around $10,000, and I'd like to have compared it to that, but let's put it this way. It was better than the one that was selling for about $4,000 to $5,000 easily, Dick, over.
Okay. It looks like we've seen the future, Mel. What's your guess as to how soon you will own one?
Okay, next year, if I make this tackle it, I do want it'll be, you know, it's still rushed out now in the market, you know, in a number of different fashions. You can homebrew it from scratch. You can homebrew it from pre-assembled boards, and you can buy it complete. So, I think that once the word gets out, this like you say, this is the future. And dinosaurs better wake up soon, Dick. Otherwise, we're going to be extinct. Over.
Mel, you and I have got 60 seconds to say goodbye. Goodbye, Dick.